Chapter 12. From behind me, Stoker gave a muffled growl, which I stifled by stepping carefully backwards onto his foot. I turned to the Baroness for an explanation.
"We did not expect His Grace until tomorrow," she said tightly. "This is an unexpected honor."
"What are the pleasures of Monte Carlo against the incomparable joy of spending time with my betrothed?"
he asked, his mouth twitching.
"Are you not in the least concerned that she is missing?"
Stoker put in. The Duke gave him a dismissive glance.
"Who is this man? He is not one of us."
"No,"
the Chancellor hastened to explain.
"He is a friend of the Fräulein's and insisted upon accompanying her for her own safety. I am to duel him later, perhaps,"
he added swiftly, as the Baroness shot him a look of displeasure. The Duke smiled again.
"How very interesting. Perhaps we will duel as well,"
he said, touching two fingers to his brow and saluting Stoker in a manner that was clearly calculated to annoy. But Stoker refused to rise to the bait.
"I have no objection,"
he said mildly. The Duke turned back to me.
"They have made a good job of you, mademoiselle, but you stand a much better chance of passing as Gisela with my help."
"What sort of help?" He raised his brows in mock reproof.
"How forbidding you look. Not easy with such a lovely face. I mean, mademoiselle, that I shall accompany you to the opera tonight."
"Out of the question,"
the Baroness stated in her best governess voice. The teasing expression turned serious.
"I think,"
the Duke said in a dangerously soft voice,
"that you do not mean to be impertinent, Baroness."
She flushed a little.
"I meant no disrespect, Your Grace."
The Duke gave her a hearty kiss upon the cheek, smacking his lips loudly.
"I am jesting with you, Margarita. You know your little Max better than that."
Her smile was indulgent.
"I spoilt you as a child, I fear."
"Impossible,"
he cried, "for I am perfect, just as I am."
The Baroness's distress had fled, and I wondered how strange it must be to rule the nursery, no doubt with an iron fist, only to have one's charge grow into manhood, poised to take the reins of power. The Duke turned his smiles to me, but there was something a little aloof in his manner, and I realized he was forcing himself to cordiality.
"The Baroness worries when she should not. Her princess is in very good hands with me, and so should you be,"
he assured me.
"You are not betrothed to our princess yet,"
the Chancellor said, lifting his chin. The Duke's eyes rested on him a moment too long for comfort. Then he nodded.
"It is truth, what you say, Chancellor. I have asked, and she has not yet accepted me. But I think we know that she will. In time."
"Are you not concerned about her whereabouts?"
Stoker asked bluntly.
"Surely that is of greater importance than helping Miss Speedwell sustain this ludicrous masquerade."
The Duke gave a thoughtful nod.
"You make an excellent point, sir, but this ludicrous masquerade is more important than you perhaps understand. I have no doubt that Gisela is perfectly fine. She is always slipping away to avoid engagements she would rather not attend. She will turn up in a day or so, looking quite pleased with herself, I promise you. Besides, he added smoothly, fluffing the plume on his shako, if it were made public that I had arrived in London and was not permitted to escort my intended wife to the opera, what a scandal this would make.
The Baroness gave a little cry of distress.
You would speak to the newspapers. Max, no.
The Duke shuddered.
You wound me, Baroness. I, highest-ranking Duke of the Alpenwald, lower myself to speak to a journalist. You insult me, he said, shaking his head with a mournful downward pull of the lips. But, naturally, as I am in London, and it is Sophie Fribourg making her debut in the role of Atalanta, it is my duty to attend and to witness her triumph. I would not let it be said that I am slow to uphold the glory of my country.
He finished with a little bow. The Baroness made no further objections, giving her former charge another of her exasperated smiles. It was left to the Chancellor to agree.
Of course, Your Grace, he said quietly.
The Duke, having got his way, rubbed his hands together and beamed a smile around the room. He put out his arm and I laid my hand on top of it. He leaned close enough so that I could smell his toilet water, something with sandalwood and herbs.
What fun we shall have together, my pretty, he murmured.
Behind me, Stoker growled again.
There is another person you ought to meet,
the Chancellor said. He signalled to the Baroness, who opened the outer door and beckoned to the guard outside. Captain Durand stood at attention, snapping his heels together as he reached the Chancellor and giving a sharp bow. No doubt for my benefit and Stoker's, the Chancellor spoke English.
Captain, you have been informed of the circumstances and what is at stake. This is Miss Speedwell, who is assuming the role of the princess for the evening. Miss Speedwell, the commander of the princess's guard, Captain Durand.
The etiquette of the little court in the Alpenwald was clearly one of formality, but there seemed no obvious protocol for greeting an ersatz princess. I nodded to him, and he clicked his heels together, giving me not the deep bow that royalty would have demanded, but a cursory nod in return.
The captain will naturally escort us this evening, but arrangements for the princess's security have been made by the special branch of the Metropolitan Police,
the Chancellor informed us. I resisted the urge to exchange glances with Stoker. There was an excellent chance that someone of our acquaintance would be amongst the policemen assigned to the princess, but I was not worried that my own masquerade would be revealed. I had long ago learnt in my field experiences as a lepidopterist that invariably one sees what one expects to see. Many species of butterfly are gifted with protective coloration, lending them the appearance of a predator's eye or a dried leaf in order to discourage those who would feed upon them. Would-be marauders give such species a wide berth because they do not see them as they are, but as what they present themselves to be. With my formal gown and jewels and royal entourage, I would appear a princess to all who looked, so long as I made no obvious missteps. Stoker, however, was another matter altogether. He was entirely too remarkable. He had pocketed his gold earrings, but the eye patch and uncommonly intelligent expression were impossible to disguise. I could only hope that with most eyes upon me, those likeliest to expose him would pass him by, oblivious to the cuckoo in the nest. The Chancellor looked at the hideous mantle clock and clucked his tongue.
"Come now, it is time,"
he urged, taking up his own befeathered hat and swirling cloak. We assembled, and as we made our way downstairs, the captain took the opportunity to speak with me.
"The resemblance is most remarkable, Fräulein,"
he said at last, his English heavily accented. "Thank you, Captain. I presume you have met Mr. Templeton Vane?" I gestured towards Stoker, and the captain's mouth pursed beneath his moustaches.
"I have. That is my uniform,"
he said with a lowering look.
"It has been altered because you are a very small man."
Stoker, whose inches just topped a perfectly respectable 6 feet, raised a brow.
"Not where it matters,"
he said, just loudly enough for me to hear.
"What is that, you say?"
the captain demanded.
"Nothing at all, Captain,"
Stoker said, smiling broadly at him.
"Nothing at all."
I received the first of many surprises that evening when we emerged from the hotel to the sight of crowds assembled on the pavement. Several constables were holding them back as they surged forward, eager for a glimpse of a princess. I cut my eyes to the Baroness. The tiara was far too heavy to permit quick movement, and she gave an almost imperceptible nod.
"Vave,"
she murmured, as she bent near to fuss with my mantle.
"Just hold your hand up in the air. Not like that. You are not a bank clerk hailing a hackney."
I tried again, simply lifting my gloved hand in a small salute. The crowd responded with a muted roar and pushed forward. The constables linked arms to push them further back, but by the time they had managed it, the Baroness had bundled me into a waiting carriage. It was a handsome affair, lavishly polished and marked with the hotel's crest.
"The Sudbury has made their equipage available for the duration of our stay,"
the Chancellor said, as he climbed in after the Baroness and I had settled ourselves. The captain swung himself up into a seat next to the driver, his hand resting loosely upon his sword. Duke Maximilian vaulted in next, leaving Stoker standing upon the pavement. The Duke favoured Stoker with a grin.
"The help rides on the outside,"
the Duke told him, as the hotel's doorman stepped smartly up to slam the door. The carriage gave a lurch as it sprang from the curb, leaving the crowds behind. Stoker must have secured a seat for himself somewhere, or perhaps he hung on the back like one of the larger brachiating primates, for he was the one who opened the carriage door as soon as we arrived at the Opera House. I was familiar with the venue, having attended the opera on the arm of Stoker's eldest brother, Tiberius, upon occasion. Tiberius and I were enthusiasts, whilst Stoker maintained that, apart from sea shanties, no decent music had been written since Handel. With his witty urbanity and love of luxury, Tiberius was a delightful escort for an evening's entertainment, and I had thoroughly enjoyed the hours spent in his velvet-draped box. But we had attended for love of the music, largely ignoring the crowds of society peepers gathered to gossip and survey with sharp-eyed interest all the goings-on, a far cry from being the guest of honour at a royal gala. My anonymous pleasure was at an end. Stoker gave a smart bow as he handed us from the carriage, and I left my hand in his a moment longer than necessary, squeezing his fingers as I let go. An even larger crowd awaited us here, intent upon seeing the elusive Princess of the Alpenwald, as well as the other dignitaries making an appearance. A long line of them stood on an azure carpet, the distinct Alpenwalder blue, I noted, laid, no doubt, as a compliment to the delegation. I walked towards them, inclining my head just enough to make the jewels swing a little. Any harder and they clattered against the frame, the Baroness had warned me. The officials were a collection of diplomats, opera patrons, society beauties and assorted hangers-on. The Baroness prodded me discreetly in the ribs to stop in front of the most heavily decorated one, a tiny little man with the usual lavish Alpenwalder facial hair.
"Your ambassador,"
the Baroness said, concealing her mouth with a subtle flick of her fan. She had explained in the carriage that the ambassador had been an appointment of the princess's grandfather and had not met the princess since she was a child. He would not recognize an impostor, she had assured me, and seeing his thick-lensed spectacles, I was inclined to agree with her. I put out my hand, leaving it hanging in the air between us.
"Excellency,"
I began. He seized it with real vigor and touched it to his forehead.
"Your Serene Highness,"
he pronounced, clicking his heels together as he bowed.
"It is a very great honor to welcome you to our host nation's most illustrious cultural institution for an event which will bind our two countries together even further in harmony."
He bowed again at the conclusion of this pompous little speech and snapped his fingers. A child, dressed in traditional Alpenwalder costume of embroidered dirndl and apron, came forward, staggering under the weight of an enormous bouquet of white roses. The ambassador presented them to me with a flourish, and I took one deep, heady inhalation of the blooms. They were so wildly out of season, they must surely have come straight from the hothouse. I smiled my thanks and passed them to the Baroness. She took them with a practiced gesture, and I moved on. Duke Maximilian stepped up to escort me up the grand staircase, turning this way and that to nod to the assembled crowds as we ascended. He shot me an amused glance.
"You are a natural at this,"
he whispered, taking care that his moustaches should brush my cheek. "It is hardly difficult," I said. I was aware of the Baroness and Chancellor hard behind us, with the Captain and Stoker bringing up the rear. The Duke and I were presenting a picture of an intimate conversation, I had little doubt. His smile deepened.
"You would be surprised. Our late Queen Adelaide was not at all personable. She used to scowl at people. Of course, it might have just looked that way because of her moustaches,"
he said with mock seriousness.
"Do not make me laugh," I told him severely. "I am meant to be regal."
He squeezed my hand where it lay upon his sleeve.
"You are delectable and delicious, and all things delightful, my dear. Do not wish to be anything other than you are."
I opened my mouth to reprove him, but we had arrived at our box. A few minutes later we were seated, the Baroness and myself in the front in a pair of little gilt chairs, with the Duke and the Chancellor behind us. I was glad of the Baroness's company, if for no other reason than she could continue to instruct me on points of etiquette, but I wondered at the wisdom of the arrangement as the Duke leant forward and put his hands upon my shoulders.
"Do not look so startled, Princess," he murmured. "I am to help you off with your cloak. You will be much too warm with it on.
He exposed my bare shoulders, drawing the velvet and fur slowly away, teasingly. From behind him, I heard Stoker growl again and gave a sigh. It was going to be a very long evening. No sooner had we settled into the box than the concertmaster and conductor appeared, accepting the enthusiastic applause from the audience. The conductor turned, bowed to me, and lifted his baton, signalling the orchestra to strike up a thunderous tune with a martial melody. Immediately, the Alpenwalders leapt to their feet, but the Baroness put a slipper firmly upon my dress, forcing me to stay seated.
"The anthem," she muttered.
I realized then that the tune they were lustily singing was their national song, Verlorene Seelen, a rather macabre invocation to the spirits of dead comrades in arms. The melody concluded with a martial crash of cymbals, and I inclined my head to the conductor to acknowledge the compliment. The Duke leant forward, his moustaches tickling my neck.
"Do you like our national anthem, Princess?"
he inquired. I did not have to look round to know he was smiling.
"My German is imperfect, but from what I could translate, it is a trifle bloodthirsty,"
I whispered back. He gave a short laugh, his breath ruffling my hair.
"We made the mistake of trying to stop Napoleon on his way to Russia. Every Alpenwalder who fought was slain, except one."
"Lucky fellow," I replied.
"He was my great-grandfather,"
the Duke told me.
"And the luck did not end with him."
I wondered what he meant by that, but the orchestra was beginning the overture, and I settled back to listen. It was a very modern opera, with a good deal of strident posturing and aggressive passages for the brasses, but all of this was nothing compared to the verve of the leading lady. Mademoiselle Fribourg threw herself into the role with tremendous passion. The first act saw the intrepid Atalanta besting every suitor at the sporting games hosted by her father. A lively scene full of colour and movement, with Mademoiselle Fribourg's legs shown to excellent advantage in a short tunic. But immediately after the athleticism of the competition, the mournful heroine stepped behind a convenient bush to lament her loneliness, pouring out her pain in a piercing aria of such sweetness, such pain, I was forced to blink back tears as the curtain came down upon the first act.
"Well, what do you think of our Atalanta?"
the Duke asked, moving his chair nearer to mine and edging the Baroness aside a little. "I think she is immensely talented," I told him.
"You do not find her figure a trifle generous for a loose-limbed athlete?"
he teased. There was something I did not quite like in the challenge of his gaze. It was as if he knew a secret joke at my expense, and I wondered at the nature of his relationship with the princess. On the contrary, it would require a robust physique to excel at such activities. I told him firmly, "She puts me in mind of the Rubens painting of the same lady." He leaned closer then, his medals clinking together. I glanced at them. "You seem to have distinguished yourself in the service of your country, Your Grace." He gave a shrug that seemed to convey both modesty and pride in his accomplishments.
"I trained at Woolwich, at your Royal Military Academy,"
he told me.
"And then I spent some time with your Queen's Army in Afghanistan as an attaché to your General Sir Samuel Brown. They like to give out medals for such things."
He spoke casually, but any man who had served under the commander of the British Army during the Second Anglo-Afghan War had seen some sharpish things. He gestured towards one of the medals, a medallion struck with Queen Victoria's image hanging from a bar of crimson and green ribbon. I peered closely at the medal, noting the inscription circling the Queen's face. "Victoria Regina et Imperatrix," I read aloud. I sat back, scrutinizing him. "You were content to risk your life in the service of another country?" His smile was enigmatic.
"One does foolish things in one's youth and in the service of love."
I started to ask him what he meant, but my gaze fell upon the decoration hanging just below the Afghanistan medal. "The climbing badge of the Teufelstrepper," I exclaimed.
"Not just a climbing badge,"
he corrected proudly.
"A summit badge."
He indicated the edge of tiny diamonds set in blue enamel.
"This indicates the bearer has successfully climbed the mountain."
Excitement surged through me, like that of a lioness catching the scent of a gazelle. "I remember reading that you climbed," I began. His laugh was quick, displaying excellent white teeth.
"My dear, everyone in the Alpenwald climbs. There are even special leading reins of leather to attach to small children to help them with their first ascents on the lower slopes. That mountain is our birthright."
He canted his head, his eyes bright with amusement.
"You have been reading about me? What sorts of things?"
I paused a moment, letting a smile ripen between us. "About your relationship with Alice Baker Green," I said softly. I watched carefully for his reaction, and there it was. A quick bob of the Adam's apple, a brief hesitation before he spoke.
"She was a gifted climber," he said casually, "and the alpinist community is a small one. Everyone meets everyone else sooner or later."
"So you were just friends?" I asked, widening my eyes at him.
"What a minx you are," he exclaimed. "You think to bewitch me into indiscretions with those beautiful violet eyes, do you not? Shall I be your devoted slave?"
His tone was arch, but there was a distinct lack of humor in his eyes. I ignored his question and decided to thrust once more, as I seemed to have knocked him a little off his balance. "What do you remember about the day she died? I hear you were an eyewitness."
"You seem to have heard quite a lot,"
he said, his gaze sharply watchful. I shrugged. "I am by profession a lady explorer, travelling the world in order to study butterflies. Naturally, I take an interest in other such women. We were both members of the same club, you understand." He blinked.
"A woman's place is at the heart and in the bed," he remarked,
giving me a fathomless smile. He gazed warmly at my face, then deliberately dropped his gaze to my décolletage and back again. "Careful, Your Grace. You are verging on boorishness," I murmured. I waited, and after a moment he sighed.
"Very well. Yes, I saw her depart that day. It was very much as usual."
"Was it usual for her to climb alone? That seems dangerous." He shrugged.
"Yes, but she was highly experienced, and it was a climb she had done many times before, and she was not planning to attempt the summit."
I lifted a brow in inquiry, and he rolled his eyes at me.
We did not discuss her climb, so you have not discovered some great secret. If she had meant to summit, she would have gone out better equipped and with a guide. She often climbed sections of the mountain in order to try different routes. She kept notes, you know.
Notes?
In a notebook.
He sketched a size with his hands.
About so large. Green kidskin. She always carried it with her to record conditions, to make little maps and notes on her experiences. There are those who say it was the key to her success as a climber. She was meticulous in her research, and she was often able to offer suggestions and tips to other mountaineers.
Such as Douglas Norton, I suggested. He made a brusque gesture of dismissal.
A disgruntled, odious little man. He was not worth half of Alice's merit as a climber.
What would you say if I told you that he was in the Alpenwald when Alice made her fatal climb? All his theatrical postures and poses fell away at that moment, and his mouth rounded in genuine astonishment.
Was he indeed?
He sat back a little, suddenly preoccupied. After a moment, he shook himself a little and gave me a faint smile.
You are a very knowledgeable woman, my dear.
I know very little, but I am curious about a good deal, I corrected.
You know, I am sure, what they say about curiosity and cats.
The comment was well pitched. It might have been a threat or merely a warning. He had resumed his attitude of lazy good humour, but he watched me closely, and I wondered which of us might really be playing at being the cat. I suppose I ought to congratulate you on your forthcoming betrothal, I said softly. Tell me, was the princess at all vexed by your attentions to Alice Baker Green? At this, he let out a sharp bark of laughter, drawing the attention of several people seated in the boxes nearest ours. Why do you laugh?
Because you are ridiculous and beautiful.
You mean she was not at all distressed that you developed a friendship with another woman? A friendship so important that you secured a permanent home for Alice in Hochstadt? His brows shot skywards in astonishment.
Who told you that?
Alice. I met her once, and she spoke most enthusiastically of your country.
What else did she tell you? Did she speak of me?
No. She talked of her eagerness to settle in the Alpenwald and how happy she was. I only learnt later that the house given to her was taken from Captain Durand at the behest of the Chancellor, no doubt acting upon the orders of someone very highly placed. I finished. He gave me a long, appreciative nod.
Well, I can only say again that you are a most surprising young woman.
I shall take that as a compliment. He smiled thinly, and I fell to thinking that this sophisticated nobleman with his weathercock moods might well have had an excellent motive for murdering Alice himself. He was a royal of the old continental variety. It was not difficult to imagine that he would find nothing untoward in settling a woman who might well have been his mistress in proximity to the castle he hoped to share with his future wife. But what if Princess Gisela had taken a different view of the matter? There was gossip about Duke Maximilian and Alice Baker Green, that much I knew, and it was likely that some of it reached the ears of the princess. In previous generations, a nobleman could expect to establish a cozy situation for himself, his wife comfortably settled in his official residence, whilst his paramour feathered their love nest. But these were modern days. Not every royal marriage included genteel adultery on the part of the husband. Our own Prince Albert had been a paragon of marital virtue, I reflected. And Gisela, as the reigning hereditary princess, held all of the cards. She could easily refuse to accept his proposal, except on her own terms. And the most logical demand would be for him to remove his lady love from Hochstadt. All of this was quite reasonable enough, and no motive for murdering the woman. Unless she refused to go quietly. I thought of Alice Baker Green, standing flushed with delight in the Curiosity Club, as she related her future plans to me. I remembered the photographs of her posed on a mountaintop with her suffragist banners and the stories of her whipping Douglas Norton down a Bolivian street to assuage her honour. Oh no. Alice Baker Green was most definitely not the sort of woman to meekly accept being cast off by a lover who found her presence burdensome, I decided. She would have staked her claim to him as stalwartly as she did a mountain summit. These thoughts chased and tangled in far less time than it takes to describe them, and as I considered them, the Duke continued to smile his oblique smile at me, until the Baroness rapped him sharply with her fan. She said something in the Alpenwalder dialect, too rapid for me to understand, and he moved his chair back again and fell into conversation with the Chancellor.
"I hope it does not trouble you too much," she began in a low voice.
I shrugged. "I have encountered many such men in my travels, Baroness," I assured her. "If he chooses to make trouble with me, he will find me a worthy adversary." Her expressions were carefully schooled, but I could tell she was distressed.
"I beg you, do not make an enemy of him. He might take it in his head to create mischief, and when he does, no one can be naughtier than our Maximilian."
There was something modestly revolting at the notion of a grown man being described as mischievous, but the Baroness was obviously troubled, and I had no wish to add to her burdens. I put a fingertip to her arm, startling her a little. "You are clearly distressed," I said. "Be of good heart, Baroness. I am certain your princess will return unharmed and soon." She said nothing, biting her lip before she darted me a grateful glance. She cleared her throat and opened her programme.
"Ah, Act Two is the love duet. That should be a most excellent scene," she began.
She carried on talking about the opera, whilst a steady stream of visitors appeared at the door of the box, offering flowers, confections, and other little tributes from admirers, whilst being carefully discouraged from entering by the lowering Teutonic presence of Captain Durand. The gifts were heaped on a small table in the corner, armfuls of carefully arranged blooms, boxes full of sugared almonds and tiny jewelled fruits, and an assortment of envelopes.
"Correspondence?" I asked the Baroness.
"Petitions," she explained. "Whenever the princess appears in public, there are those who present her with their needs. If it is in her power to assist them, she will do so."
I watched the Chancellor carefully bundle the envelopes before tucking them into his pocket.
"It is my responsibility to assess the worthiness of each claim before passing it along to Her Serene Highness," he told me smoothly.
I realized then how very isolated the princess must be. She seldom travelled outside her own country, and even when she went in public, there was little opportunity for anyone to speak to her without the interference of her entourage. Before I could ask, Duke Maximilian spied a bottle of costly champagne amidst the offerings and pounced upon it like a house cat upon a mouse.
"Now we have the makings of a party," he proclaimed.
He snapped his fingers at Stoker to find glasses. I held my breath, waiting for Stoker's response, but I need not have worried. He was finding the entire affair amusing, I realized. He signalled to an usher passing by the open door of the box for coupes as the Duke popped the cork with a lavish gesture, sending it flying into the crowd below. They laughed and dove for it, a little memento of their night at the opera with a foreign princess. "Madness," I murmured, as Duke Maximilian handed me a frothing glass of the golden wine.
"That they leap for rubbish? It is indeed. But such is the lot of royalty, my dear," he said, touching his glass to mine. "Blue blood carries magic in it."
"You cannot really believe that," I protested. He shrugged.
"I am a pragmatist. I believe what serves me."
"You are an opportunist," I corrected, and he laughed, loudly enough that half the theatre turned to look.
"Ah, they see now how well we get on. I must thank you for that,"
he said, raising his glass.
"It is because we make such a beautiful couple. Just think how handsome our children will be."
"You are impossible," I told him.
"I am adorable,"
he corrected.
"I am a charming rogue, and you are perplexed because you find that you like me more than you want to."
"Did someone tell you that confidence is attractive in a gentleman?" I asked sweetly. "Because if they did, you have taken it entirely too far."
"A gentleman can never be too confident. He must believe in his abilities, even when no one else does," he said. "I have always believed that I possess the qualities necessary to make a worthy consort."
His gaze dropped to his glass, where bubbles were still rising through the champagne. It was excellent stuff, the colour of pale straw and tasting of toast with a hint of jam. I finished my first glass and the Duke hastened to refill my coupe. "But there is doubt in some quarters," I guessed.
"I enjoy life very much. Too much, some would say. They think me not serious enough to play such an important role in my country's future."
He seemed sincere then, and I liked him better than I had up to that point. "What would you like that role to be?" He considered this a moment.
"I should like to be the sort of man who could make Gisela proud. This surprises you? Do not deny it. I can see the astonishment on your face, my dear, but it is true."
"You really care for her, then?"
"How can you doubt it?"
His expression softened.
"I have known her since childhood. We are cousins, after all, though distantly so. I was always the disgraceful boy with the untidy hair and the pockets full of frogs or French cigarettes."
I widened my eyes and he smiled.
"I was a very mature boy, but I cared much for her, and I still do. She was so serious, so lovely, and always restricted."
His gaze fell to the tight lacing of my waist and rose slowly to the heavy jewels at my wrists and head.
You feel a little of that, do you not? How one must suffocate. I always tried to relieve her of that.
You encouraged her to misbehave, I guessed.
She needed little enough encouragement,
he told me.
There was always a rebel beneath the royal, but whenever we got ourselves into trouble, I took the blame. It was easy enough. Everyone knew who we were. Gisela, the good girl, and Maximilian, the scoundrel.
His tone was mocking, but his lips took a wistful turn.
More than once, I was whipped for some plot of her making. Still, I do not regret it.
I imagine there is little you do regret, I said.
Why don't we do something scandalous and find out?
With that, he settled back into his chair and sipped his champagne, never breaking eye contact with me.
Enjoying yourself?
Came a voice at my ear. I turned to see Stoker kneeling just behind me in a posture of supplication. What are you doing on the floor? I demanded. Get up at once.
I cannot sit in your presence,
he told me in mock seriousness.
It is a violation of royal etiquette, but I can kneel in devotion to my princess.
You are an ass, I hissed.
I am also about to save you a good deal of trouble,
he told me. He turned his head away from the theatre.
Do not look now. In the stalls, second row on the end.
Who is it?
Who is the very last person you would want to see in your current guise?
He asked. Mornaday. It was a name, but I said it like an expletive. Stoker nodded.
Mercifully, his duties demand he pay closer attention to the audience than the royal box, and he has not looked often this way. If he suspects for a moment...
He broke off. There was no need for him to finish the sentence. Mornaday had occasionally played the ally. One might even consider him a friend, but an ambitious second-in-command at Scotland Yard was not the person to conspire with to impersonate a foreign royal. If he got as much as a sniff of something amiss with the Alpenwalder delegation, he would be after it like a hungry dog with a juicy bone. Stoker spoke again.
Try drawing a little less attention to yourself,
he suggested. I edged my chair back a little, casting my face deeper into the shadows. That is the best I can do. I am supposed to be the guest of honour at this event, I reminded him.
Imperious as a princess already,
he returned lightly.
I think I shall make you clean my walrus when we go home, just to put you in your proper place.
He dared a quick wink before resuming his post in the rear of the box. I drank deeply of my champagne. Home. The word was jarring in this context. I had never had a home, not a real one. My aunts and I had moved frequently for reasons I had come to understand only too late. My travels had taken me around the world, drawing me across the globe and back again in pursuit of my beloved butterflies. I never tarried long in any spot, for the fear that I would become too rooted, too settled. But with our employment at the Belvedere and the eccentric lodgings of which we had both become fond, to say nothing of our personal attachment, I found myself for the first time perched on the edge of domesticity. It was a terrifying thought. Hearthsides and cradles held no charms for me. I was unfettered as the east wind, I reminded myself, and the sooner Stoker realized I had no interest in darning shirts and stirring cookpots, the better off we would both be. I turned in my chair to meet Duke Maximilian's delighted gaze as I held out my glass again. "I would like more champagne," I announced.
"With pleasure, Princess," he said, obliging me.
I caught the Baroness's glance of reproof as I started on my third glass. The coupes were small, scarcely bigger than thimbles, and I was well capable of handling my intoxicants, I thought in some irritation. Besides, the combination of the handsome Duke, the jewels, and the danger of what I was doing was heady enough. I had spent too long cocooned in the security of the Belvedere, pinning mounts and answering correspondence. For just these few hours, I was on the tightrope again, balanced precariously between glory and disaster, and the thrill of it coursed through me with far more effect than the glittering wine. I raised my glass to Duke Maximilian. "To your very good health, Your Grace." He grinned and touched his glass to mine. Chapter 13. The rest of the performance passed in a golden haze from the fairy tale circumstances, heightened no doubt by the excellence of the champagne, as well as the liminal magic of the opera itself. The librettist had clearly been inspired by Handel's work of the same name, but his handling of the myth of Atalanta was altogether darker. The first act saw the princess thwart her father's attempts to see her matched with a man who could best the fleet-footed heroine in a race. In this version, a suitor dropped enchanted golden apples to distract her, but Atalanta was guarded by Artemis, protectress of chaste maidens, and the goddess gave her heightened speed so she might win in spite of the conspiracy of men to cheat her into marriage. The act had finished with the princess singing of her triumph, but also of her loneliness, her longing for someone of her own choosing to share her victories as well as her woes. The second act had been set upon an enormous ship, the Argo, as Atalanta and a crew of heroes sailed for the Golden Fleece, a quest in which the princess distinguished herself by her daring, although the men around her plotted to take her share of the spoils. Enraged, she took her revenge upon them, before running away to hide out as a shepherdess. Her disguise was penetrated when the hunt for the Caledonian boar passed, and she must join or die. Reaching for her spear, she embraced her true destiny at last, spitting the beast and saving the kingdom from his ravaging. When the other hunters disparaged her, a young huntsman named Meleaga stood alone in her defense. The tenor cast in the role was heartbreakingly young, bewailing the fact that he would never be worthy of her love, but vowing he would take her side against his own uncles, who plotted to kill her. Finding at last a man whose honor was as great as hers, Atalanta bestowed her hand upon him, and a tremendous wedding chorus was sung as the lovers were joined in marriage. But the goddess Artemis, petitioned by Meleaga's uncles and angered at losing her devoted handmaiden, cast the bridegroom into a pyre, causing Atalanta to deliver a widow's aria, shivering the rafters with its eldritch lament. It was a thing of fire and rage. Her grief smelted in the crucible of loss into purest anger and a vow of revenge against those who plotted against her. The opera ended with Atalanta, silhouetted by fire, spear raised against a dying sun, triumphant even in the knowledge that she will go to her death, destroyed by the goddess she once served for her blasphemies.
"We do not much care for happy endings," Duke Maximilian murmured in my ear. "We are too pragmatic for that, but I think it disturbs you British," he added, with a nod towards the audience below.
The English crowd, rather uncomfortable with equivocal endings, applauded politely. Suddenly, I realized all eyes were fixed upon the royal box. My reaction, for good or ill, would determine whether the work was a success or a dismal failure. In that moment, I held the fate of Mademoiselle Fribourg, of the entire cast, of the composer Burton, of the world's opinion of Alpenwalder culture, in my gloved hands. Slowly, deliberately, I rose to my feet and began to clap. The kidskin muffled the sound, but still it echoed throughout the opera house. The applause began haltingly, like drops of rain pattering on a roof. I fancied I could hear each pair of hands clapping alone in the darkness. Then more and still more, the sound rising to a storm. Then a deluge of approbation as the curtain rose and the cast took their bows, the chorus and lesser performers first. Then the goddess and the suitors, and finally Mademoiselle Fribourg herself. Bouquets were hurled along with cries of brava, and the lady curtsied deeply, gesturing towards the orchestra pit. The conductor, Monsieur Burton, who had also composed the work, leapt onto the stage at her invitation. They joined hands and faced the royal box. As one, the entire cast and orchestra bowed deeply to me, Mademoiselle Fribourg's nose nearly touching the stage. When she rose, I saw tears glittering on her cheeks, and Burton seized her hand, kissing it ardently. Whatever else happened that night, I told myself, I had done some good for these people. When the ovations were ended, the Chancellor shepherded us out of the royal box, just as the ambassador appeared, his moustaches quivering in delight.
"A triumph, an absolute triumph," he exclaimed, "and all due to your Serene Highness's enthusiastic response."
"I think it is rather more to do with the quality of the music and the performance," I told him.
"So gracious," he murmured. "Naturally, you will wish to pay your compliments directly to the performers and the composer, madam. So I have arranged for a private audience backstage, if you would step this way."
He bowed low, extending his arm. I looked to the Chancellor for help, but he merely lifted one shoulder in a tiny shrug. I should have to make the best of it, I decided. I followed the ambassador, the rest of the Alpenwalder entourage trailing behind. The cast and orchestra and stagehands were arranged in a long line in the wings. The proprietors naturally took pride of place, beaming and bowing, and obviously enormously relieved, as their gamble on a new production would pay handsomely now that they had a bona fide success on their hands. I accepted their fervent thanks with a solemn inclination of the head, and a few words murmured in the faint Germanic accent the Baroness had made me practice. They pressed bouquets of roses upon me, heaps of blooms, all tied with Alpenwalder blue. The Baroness fairly staggered under the weight as she tottered behind me. The proprietors presented the various singers and musicians, and I felt my face would crack with the effort of smiling at them all. At last, the presentation was finished, and I moved to leave, Mademoiselle Fribourg doing her best to hold back tears of joy as Edward Burton clasped her hand, and others crowded around, staring avidly at what must have been their closest sighting of royalty. It was astonishing to see the effect it had upon them. I was still myself, as much plain Veronica Speedwell as I had ever been, but since I had been presented to them as a princess, they believed it. The jewels and the gown and the fact that people called me Highness had somehow rendered me almost sacred, and there was a touch of worshipfulness I did not entirely like. Strip away the costly trappings, and I was no more or less than any of them, I thought angrily, and yet they could not see past the dazzling display of wealth and power. The atmosphere of the theatre suddenly seemed oppressive, so many pairs of staring eyes gleaming in the darkened wings, so many hands reaching out to touch just a fingertip to the hem of my gown. I remembered then that it had once been the custom for the common people to be given the carpets walked upon by medieval royalty, how the cloth laid for a coronation had been cut to bits by the flashing knives of a joyous, terrifying mob. How quickly they might turn, I realized in horror. How suddenly the mood of a group of people might shift from adulation to anger. And what might they do if sufficiently provoked? Something of what I felt must have shown on my face, for the Baroness whispered urgently to the Chancellor, and he stepped forward.
Her Serene Highness must take her leave of you now,
he pronounced, in a tone that brooked no argument. I nodded to them all one last time and followed the Chancellor gratefully as he forged a path for us through the opera house and out onto the pavement. The carriage was waiting, I saw with a sigh of relief. I suddenly could not bear the weight of it all a moment more. The jewels and corset and heavy gown conspired to make me feel like a draft horse, and I was exhausted from carting them about. I could scamper up and down hillsides from dawn till dusk in pursuit of my favourite butterflies, but the notion of keeping myself trussed up for another minute was utterly unthinkable. The Alpenwalder entourage and I moved towards the carriage, the opera-goers gathered on two sides and penned by the Metropolitan Police in an orderly fashion to shout and wave their goodbyes. I raised my hand to acknowledge them, turning to look behind me, and just as I did so, there was a pop, a flash of light, and a vibration that nearly knocked me off of my feet. The events of the next few moments were so swift, they seemed to happen simultaneously. There was a scream, I later learnt it was from the Baroness, and a roar of outrage, this from Stoker. A scuffle ensued, and I saw Stoker flying through the air and into the crowd in front of me and to the left. The captain rushed from my right side to hoist me into his arms. He did not bother to put me on my feet to enter the carriage, but rather hurtled himself through the open door, still clutching me to his chest. We landed on the seat, my body crushed beneath him, knocking the wind from my lungs as he shouted for the driver to whip the horses. Behind us came the Chancellor and the Baroness, thrown through the door of the carriage by Duke Maximilian, who was still standing with one foot on the steps when the driver sprang the horses and they leapt from the curb. The Duke turned, extended a hand, and Stoker emerged from the crowd just in time to grasp it. The pair of them fell into the carriage at our feet, and the door swung madly on its hinges as we raced through the streets. Sounds were oddly muffled, but I could make out screams as I struggled to push the captain off of me. "What is happening?" I demanded. My voice sounded strange to my ears, distant and small. The captain sat back and helped me up, settling me gently into my seat. It took some time for us to disentangle ourselves and take stock. But apart from a burnt patch on Stoker's uniform and medals torn from the Duke's and the Baroness's badly dented tiara, we were fine, if badly shaken. "What happened?" I repeated. Stoker's expression was grim, and I had to watch his mouth move to understand his words.
"You have just survived your first bomb attack, Princess,"